So good day, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Striving for Consensus on the Optimal Management of HER2-Positive Breast Cancer. We have an outstanding faculty today and also several general medical oncologists and community-based practice who will be presenting cases to us. Today we have Dr. Virginia Borges, Dr. Sarah Hurwitz, and Dr. Ian Kropp as our faculty. What we're going to be doing today is really focusing on questions and comments, and particularly cases from these general medical oncologists of patients with HER2-positive disease that they would like to hear discussed. Just before we kind of get started with HER2-positive disease, I did want to query you about a comment that one of the docs, Dr. Rodriguez, made to me that I had not heard before. I don't know, maybe it's already out there in the literature and you all know a lot about it or you've never heard of it. But I am really curious. She had some comments about her observations on the impact of COVID vaccinations on mammograms. Here's Dr. Rodriguez.
We have seen this, and the mammographers are the ones who have seen this first, because people haven't had mammograms during COVID, a lot of patients, and now they're getting them. Some patients around the time of their vaccine, and they're presenting with uptake in the breast or lesions in the breast and axillary nodes. And I have seen both ipsilateral axillary nodes in the site of the COVID vaccine injection, but I also seen contralateral. There were no cancer patients in any of the COVID trials. We're going to learn a lot of things about what happens when people get vaccines. And one of the things we learn is that the mammograms and the PET scans can light up.
So, you know, it's been a pretty interesting year going around the country and around the world asking people what's going on and how COVID and social distancing and everything else has affected clinical practice. Just so maybe start with you, Sarah. Any thoughts? I had not heard about this. I don't know if it, have you seen it? Has it been reported, this issue about vaccinations?
Yeah, it actually has been reported. One of my patients actually messaged me about 2 weeks ago and said, I received the vaccine. Should I be canceling or postponing my mammogram? Apparently, she had seen an article stating that this phenomenon is actually happening where axillary nodes are being picked up and they're false positives. And so I contacted our radiologist who agreed we should postpone it. And then last week, one of my colleagues, Tony Rebus, who is fairly well known for his work in melanoma and immune therapy, sent around to all of us a scan of a patient of his where the lymph nodes blew up in the mediastinum and abdominal region and axillary region. And they did a workup. It was all reactive. And it occurred 2 to 3 weeks after a vaccine. So more and more were beginning to see that probably we shouldn't be scanning patients who have active cancer within a month or so of their COVID vaccine, and we should be delaying mammography unless, of course, we have an urgent situation.
I'm curious, Ginger, for your thoughts on this, and also whether it's kind of hard to tell, but whether you think you're seeing more advanced disease, people who've delayed. We have a case of a patient who kind of delayed getting care, whether you think this is happening at a significant level. Ginger, any thoughts also about this issue with the vaccinations?
So when it comes to the vaccines, my first experience was with a physician I've taken care of for many years who has a history of oligometastatic disease and been without evidence of scan findings. And she just happened to have gotten her COVID vaccine the day before she had her follow-up PET CT. And since she was a physician, we could walk towards it calmly, but there was a substantial amount of uptake. Thankfully, it was not where her known sites of Mets were, and it has subsequently gone down. I myself experienced significant lymphadenopathy on the side where I got my second shot, and it made me realize I'm going to get a lot of phone calls into my clinic. So we started putting out, call it public service announcements, on our cancer center website to our local communities, warning them of this. And our mammographers have seen the same phenomenon. And so we're just trying to educate people. My viewpoint is you should get the vaccine when you can get the vaccine, because ultimately everyone who's willing should get the vaccine in my world. But I think just making sure that people don't get fearful about these side effects. And then as far as the presentation of cancers and their stages, we have seen an increased trend, and it is concerning. And we have folks who have delayed coming in and have substantial lymphadenopathy, and quite a few cases presenting with metastatic stage 4 disease de novo. So we definitely want folks starting to re-engage with their healthcare system and their preventative medicine.
Ian, any thoughts on this? You know, Dr. Rodriguez mentioned uptake in the breast also. I mean, like in the nose, okay, but the breast seems kind of interesting. Any thoughts on all this, Ian?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely a real finding. I wasn't aware of changes within the breast itself. I haven't heard that reported, but certainly changes in the nodes is very clearly something that can be vaccine related. I actually had a patient who was on a clinical trial and had restaging scans per the trial and was called to have progressive disease by our trial radiologist. And it was only afterwards that we found out she had gotten the vaccine a week later. And it was the axillary adenopathy on the vaccinated arm that led to her having PD being called. So it's definitely real. Again, I haven't heard about actual changes within the breast itself, but it certainly seems a possibility.
Well, let's get into some real cases. That was really interesting. But I want to start out with this patient of Dr. Alan Astro. Is a 42-year-old woman who presents with ER-positive, PR-positive, HER2-positive, triple-positive disease. Starts out on neoadjuvant TCHP, has problems with that, ends up on THP, but has a path CR at surgery. And here are Dr. Astro's questions for us to address.
Now that she's had a CR, could I just give her trastuzumab to finish the year? Or should I give her trastuzumab plus pertuzumab? Does she need a whole year since she's had a CR, ER-positive patient, T2 cancer, very high Ki-67? Is this the patient you'd consider giving neratinib to? She's a nurse. She's on her feet all day. There are GI side effects to neratinib. I can imagine that possibly interfering with her ability to work. What's his experience with neratinib and many tricks to control the diarrhea? And what does he think the degree of benefit is with neratinib? These patients have already been through a whole year of anti-HER2 therapy. They want to get off the therapy. Is it worth it?
So, Ian, we know that when we ask investigators, and we'll show this later, what they do post-op in patients with past CR, in this situation, they almost always say both trastuzumab and pertuzumab. But what kind of numbers would you give? Of course, it varies on the situation, but roughly, what kind of numbers would you give for a recurrence rate with patients with path CR, Ian? So that's one question. And the second is in terms of his thought about de-escalating the therapy, maybe just using trastuzumab without pertuzumab or less than a year. Any thoughts on those two questions?
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of outcomes, I mean, certainly patients with HER2-positive disease who have pathologic complete response seem to have really exceptionally good outcomes and very few responses. I think there is the controversy regarding what their adjuvant therapy should be after achieving a past CR, whether we should continue the trastuzumab and pertuzumab, which is what got them the past CR, or just de-escalating therapy, as the oncologist asked, whether she could be okay with just trastuzumab alone. I mean, in my mind, it depends on how much disease we think she had to begin with, since we know that the long-term benefits of adjuvant pertuzumab seem restricted to patients with higher risk disease, particularly node-positive cancer. So if this patient really had a barely stage 2 node-negative cancer and had a past CR, which we know is associated with a very good outcome, I think just proceeding with trastuzumab alone and endocrine therapy would be very reasonable. And but if she had evidence of nodal disease to begin with and at the time of surgery had fibrosis in the nodes, then I would include both trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And I really would not entertain the idea of using neratinib in this patient, given that we expect her to have a very good outcome with now that she's had a PCR.
So, Ginger, I'm curious about your thoughts on this. And also, what kind of trials are going on sort of in this space nowadays in the post neoadjuvant space? Obviously, we saw the Catherine trial that really changed practice, but what other questions are being asked there? I think I've seen a trial that involves ducatinib in the residual disease space. And also, how you manage patients who have higher risk presentations, still have a PATH CR, and what the upper end of the risk for relapse is in patients with PATH CR?
Yeah, so I would say I agree with the plan for this particular patient, given that it sounded like she was node negative up front. I think continuation of just the trastuzumab without the addition of the pertuzumab is a good choice. I have not de-escalated therapy in terms of duration of the trastuzumab based on the 6 month versus 1 year randomized study. I still tend to use the trastuzumab for the full year. I wouldn't consider her for neratinib with the presentation that she had of the stage of her disease at the beginning and the fact that she had a PATH CR. So where we are with ongoing research in this space is looking at women who don't achieve a PATH CR and have residual disease at the time of their surgery after neoadjuvant treatment. There is a cooperative group study that is part of a series of studies known as the COMPASS HER2 trials. And this one is specifically COMPASS HER2 dash RD for residual disease. And this will take women who would be eligible for TDM1 based on the outcome of the previously published Catherine trial. And they are going to be randomized to the standard 14 doses of TDM1 in comparison to TDM1 plus the TKI tucatinib that will be given overlapping with those 14 doses.
What do we know, Ginger, about that combination? I'm not sure I've kind of heard much about it. TDM1, it sounds really interesting, but TDM1 and tucatinib, Ginger.
So there was a phase 1b study that was completed as a multi-site center. And so that was published in 2019, and it demonstrated great efficacy of the combination of the TDM1 and the tucatinib with both good progression-free survival, and also there was evidence of efficacy against brain mets because women who enrolled on that clinical trial were allowed to have either treated or untreated asymptomatic or progressing but not symptomatic brain mets at that time, not requiring imminent therapy. And so that was published a couple of years ago, and it is the basis for which there's currently a randomized study in the metastatic setting and the support for bringing this into the post-neoadjuvant setting in combination with the TDM1. Great safety trial from that phase 1b2.
So, Sarah, any other comments on this case, on this clinical situation? And I'm going to relay a question I've heard from general medical oncologists that the recurrence rate after PATH CR is not zero. Depending on the situation, you know, it's not zero. It's more than 10% at least, probably a good bit more than that. And of course, we don't know from the trial, but you look over at the Catherine study and see that getting knocked in half. Any rationale in any situation to consider TDM1 in a patient with a PATH CR, Sarah? And also this question of neratinib, how you approach it, particularly in patients who've had neoadjuvant therapy and have had pertuzumab.
Yeah, just to be a little bit controversial, I agree with everything that Ginger and Ian said, but just to throw in a little devil's advocate about neratinib. Neratinib has been shown to possibly decrease the incidence of brain metastases. Now, the numbers are very small from Extenet, but we do know that it penetrates the blood-brain barrier. Its efficacy seems to be restricted to those patients with hormone receptor co-expression, which this patient had. But I do discuss it with my patients, even if they've had a PATH CR, given that trastuzumab and TDM1 don't appear to have that type of benefit in terms of reducing the risk of brain metastases. I'm really excited to see the data from COMPASS because I think tucatinib is much better tolerated. I would be really excited to use this in place of neratinib given its better tolerability profile. And I think that the amount of benefit, absolute benefit for this particular patient by adding a year of neratinib is single digits, a very small improvement, if any. So I'm just throwing it out there that one might have a discussion. Let's say somebody with this patient had a high Ki-67, maybe 5-centimeter tumor, has a PATH CR, but really high risk features, young woman. I would at least discuss it with the patient. And if she was really motivated, might consider using neratinib here, given that there was hormone receptor co-expression. In terms of TDM1 use, I'm pretty much restricting it to patients who had residual disease. I can't think of a patient where I would use it who had a pathologic complete response.
When you said that you thought this new approach with the tucatinib might affect neratinib use. Do you mean just by bringing down the absolute benefit because you're going to reduce recurrence more?
Yeah, if COMPASS is positive, that's what I should have said. If COMPASS is a positive study, I'm assuming it will be. And so that's a big assumption. So I'm not doing it at this point. But if it is a positive study, both tucatinib and neratinib are tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Tucatinib does penetrate the blood-brain barrier, as Ginger was indicating earlier on the phase 1b study and then the HER2CLIMB trial, of course. And so I wouldn't see a situation where we'd be using both tucatinib and neratinib in the early stage setting. Tucatinib's benefits appear to be irrespective of hormone receptor co-expression, whereas neratinib in the adjuvant setting seems restricted to those patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2-positive breast cancer.
That's a great point. We actually have a case where there's going to be a question of would you use tucatinib after neratinib, but we'll get to that in a second. Ian, you had a thought?
Yeah, no, I was going to say that, you know, in addition to these trials looking at escalation of therapy for positive patients with residual disease, like the COMPASS-RD, like the NRG trial looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan in that setting, there's also interest in de-escalating therapy. And this kind of gets to the particular patient who we just heard about. And the oncologist had a concern that they weren't able to get the TCHP because of tolerability and just got THP. There are studies that actually part of this COMPASS trial being done in the cooperative group system that is enrolling patients with stage 2 and 3 HER2-positive cancers and just giving them THP for 4 cycles. And if they have a pathologic complete response, not giving any additional chemotherapy by design, because we do know, of course, that the patients with PCR tend to do very well. So I think we're approaching HER2-positive breast cancer now from both ends. Patients with high-risk disease who have residual cancer, we're trying to escalate with some of these newer, more potent therapies. And at the same time, we're trying to de-escalate patients who are likely to do very well with more minimal therapy. And that's going to be a lot of patients. I mean, the PCR rate with THP is over 50%. So probably half of our patients or more may not need much more than 4 cycles of a taxane.
So just to be clear, you're talking, Ian, about post-op not using anything, anti-hair therapy at all in a patient with past
CR? No more chemotherapy. No more chemotherapy. They would continue with their antibodies. But it's, you know, it's the chemotherapy that causes most of the toxicity.
Right. Another question that comes up, Ginger, is the patient with minimal residual disease, like 2 millimeters of invasive disease. Do you still use TDM1 regardless of how much residual disease, Ginger?
I have been. I think it gets hard to know when you get down to things like single digits of millimeters. But I think if something were able to survive in the breast after a regimen like TCH or TCHP or the THP that we'll be doing in the COMPASS PathCR clinical trial to see how that works for higher stage cancers, any survivability of a tumor cell despite that regimen makes me concerned as to what the capacity of that tumor cell is. And so then in that case, I will cross them over to the TDM1, at least discuss it with them in terms of where we understand the data to be right now.
So let's move on now and talk about another case. This is also a patient of Dr. Astrow, 73-year-old woman with an ERPR negative HER2 positive tumor. And he starts her out on TCHP. And as you'll hear, she develops shortness of breath, a pretty unusual cause of it. Here's Dr. Astrow.
She had a great response to treatment, but after 5 cycles of TCHP, she got short of breath. I sent her to a pulmonologist, and sure enough, she has got pulmonary fibrosis. They thought it was trastuzumab-induced pulmonary fibrosis. She had residual cancer. What do I do with residual cancer? She's better. She's still a little short of breath on exertion, but she's improved. She was definitely ER negative, HER2 positive. Then all of a sudden, at the mastectomy, she's ER positive, PR negative, HER2 negative. So what do I do with that? Should she get post-op radiation to the left breast when she's got pulmonary fibrosis? So should she get tamoxifen, anastrozole, TDM1, capecitabine? What should we give her?
So, Sarah, they say anything can cause pneumonitis, but I hadn't heard about it with trastuzumab. I don't know whether you've ever seen. Any thoughts about it? And also this issue, and we had a bunch of cases, like this is one of the most common questions oncologists have, people whose ER and HER2 status changes after they get new adjuvant therapy and they go to surgery. This patient went from being ER negative, HER2 positive, to being ER positive, HER2 negative. So two issues there. One is this pulmonary thing that happened with this patient, and your thoughts about that. And then in terms of therapy at this point, seeing these change in markers.
Yeah, so pneumonitis was described in the original trastuzumab phase 1 studies. I've talked to Dr. Slayman about this when we were sort of talking about trastuzumab deruxtecan and the pneumonitis we see with that. And he recalled seeing it with trastuzumab as a single agent in the early studies. HER2 receptors are expressed on lung tissue, and perhaps there's a mechanistic reason why you might see it, although it's very rare. In the 15 years I've practiced, I've seen it maybe once. So yes, it's possible. I'd want to explore all other causes to make sure that that is indeed the case and work with the pulmonologist closely to see whether or not the patient would not be able to safely receive further HER2-targeted therapy. And then this folds into the findings at surgery, which were strikingly different from the findings at her initial biopsy. In these cases, I will always get tissue from the core biopsy and the surgical sample and send them both to a pathologist with expertise in breast cancer. Right across town from me is Mike Press at USC, so I'll use him in a lot of these cases. And occasionally he'll say, look, HER2 was never really amplified. We've got some aneuploidy going on here. The ratio is barely above, but this is not a HER2-driven cancer. And then we're off the hook with needing HER2-targeted therapy. But sometimes what's happened is the HER2-targeted therapy and chemo has eradicated the HER2 positive component and left behind the more indolent ER positive HER2 negative type of cancer. So I try and understand the biology by getting a pathology second opinion. In the Catherine trial, they did look at a subset of patients, somewhere around 70 patients or so, who at the time of surgery truly had HER2 negative breast cancer. I think this was presented at ESMO last year or ESMO Breast. And the patients who received T-DM1 had zero recurrences, but there were a handful of recurrences in the patients assigned to receive standard trastuzumab. Now, it's exploratory, it's small numbers of patients, but it's at least reassuring that T-DM1 may still have benefit in those patients whose residual disease was not HER2 truly positive.
So, curious, Ginger, I don't know how often you might run into this situation where you see a change in markers, what you do about it, and also, again, any comments about this pneumonitis. I mean, assuming that that is the clinical diagnosis that you come up with, and assuming that for real it looks like the patient was HER2 positive, now is HER2 negative, ER positive, what would you think about doing right now?
Well, I think the frequency with which we see these markers change is absolutely dependent upon the frequency with which we check. And I think it's become much more commonplace to look at the markers on the residual disease, and we have a lot to explore there. Having faced this challenge in a couple of my younger patients, I delved through what then happens to these patients should they have a recurrence. And I have some cases where they were not HER2 positive on the residual disease and yet recurred, and that disease was still HER2 positive. So we don't know that the biology of what's left behind in the breast, which we use as our indicator for success in the metastatic setting, tells us who is alive or not alive out in the microscopic residual disease place. So I think going forward with some HER2 targeted therapy, despite the switch in markers, makes sense. Of course, the due diligence of the path review that Sarah outlined is incredibly important. You want to make sure you know what you're treating to the best that we are able to. For the pneumonitis issue, well, I've been around long enough that those original trastuzumab studies were the start of my career. And yes, the pneumonitis can happen. It's not frequent, thank goodness. And it is usually reversible. And it is one of those side effects like the cardiomyopathy situation in advanced disease that if you're careful about it, you can re-challenge and keep treating. But having a really good pulmonary team on board and making sure that the patient's going to be compliant and being seen frequently is important. It is not a verboten concept to re-challenge this patient and switch or to something like DM1 to give her the advantage there. She's 73, and so that's going to be a big risk-benefit kind of discussion because we want her to be cured. But we know in the modern era that even if she were to have a recurrence later on down the line, she may yet achieve a natural life expectancy. So a lot of the patient's input here is going to be needed.
Ryan?
So I think one other thing to think about in this case is that taxanes also can cause pneumonitis. So I think you have several potential etiologies here. And I agree that if her pulmonary disease becomes less pronounced, if she's no longer symptomatic, it would be reasonable to go ahead with additional HER2 therapy since it may not have been the culprit here. I probably would use the least potentially toxic, so I probably would just use trastuzumab, and you could consider adding pertuzumab. T-DM1 has more pneumonitis than trastuzumab or taxanes, so I probably would stay away from that, at least at the beginning, to make sure she's tolerating at least trastuzumab.
So I'm going to go through some of the survey results that we saw here, and Sarah, this first one I thought was kind of interesting. It's always interesting when you see heterogeneity in responses. And we said, what's the size of the smallest tumor you use neoadjuvant therapy? And we saw everything from 0.5 to 2.1. I guess this becomes the art of oncology. Sarah, any thoughts?
Yeah, it's funny. The original studies of neoadjuvant therapy for HER2-positive breast cancer, looking at trastuzumab and pertuzumab combinations, which is what we do, generally restricted enrollment to patients whose tumors were 2 centimeters or greater or lymph node positive, which is why I think the most common answer is 2 centimeters. But for us to think that a 1.5 centimeter tumor is less risky than a 2 centimeter tumor, I mean, where is the evidence that 5 millimeters really matters, especially if you're looking at patients who may have a higher grade 1.5 centimeter versus an ER positive, lower grade 2 centimeter tumor. So you have to take into account all of these various factors. And I learned early in my career to respect the biology. Size isn't as important as one thought initially when we're talking about the HER2 positive realm. And I saw patients with 1 millimeter, 2 millimeter invasive HER2 positive breast cancers come back 3 years later with metastatic disease when they didn't receive systemic therapy. So it doesn't matter if you give the systemic therapy that you want to give prior to surgery or after surgery, the outcome's going to be the same. I don't think that's the issue. The real question is, are we going to use the pathologic response at the time of surgery to dictate what treatment we give after surgery? And that becomes really important, I think, in tumors that are a little bit larger. I kind of stick with my 1.5 centimeter. I have treated one patient with a 1 centimeter, but in general, 1.5 centimeter is about my cutoff.
Ian, you want to talk about your 2 centimeters, so what are your thoughts?
No, the only reason I'm bringing it up, I agree with Sarah that 1.5 to 2, we're splitting hairs. I think what I would want to bring up is that approaching this a little differently, which is that we know that stage 1 HER2 positive cancers do extremely well treated with paclitaxel and trastuzumab. In the APT trial, 4 out of 400 patients had a recurrence. So knowing that that patient with the 1.5 centimeter cancer or the 2 centimeter cancer would fit that criteria, and we know can essentially be almost guaranteed a cure with TH alone, it doesn't seem there's a big reason to do neoadjuvant therapy and look at that biology since we know that they're virtually guaranteed to do well. And if you treat with neoadjuvant therapy and then they don't have a PCR, now you're going to scratch your head and say, okay, well, maybe this patient needs T-DM1. And it just leads down a path where these patients are getting more treatment in many cases than they probably need. So that's, to me, the reason not to be treating these small cancers with neoadjuvant therapy is because we know that they do very well without any additional therapy beyond TH.
So Ginger, I'd like you to take a look at a few of these graphics related to residual disease. And I'll note also in the lower right part, we have 2 of the general medical oncologists who presented cases to us, their answers. So the rest are all investigators. So Ginger, we say path CR. Everybody says trastuzumab, pertuzumab, the investigators. I call that a consensus. We say one centimeter residual disease and it's three nodes. Everybody says TDM1. I call that a consensus. Then we start to get a little bit more variation when we bring it down to 1 millimeter of residual disease in one node. And now still almost everybody, but now you see one investigator, one general medical oncologist who says, well, maybe just trastuzumab, pertuzumab. Any thoughts, Ginger?
Well, thank you for giving me a little bit of an easy one with the first two slides being complete consensus. You know, the conundrum of a micrometastasis in the lymph node is probably going to bring out then the concern of, is that truly the prognosis of metastatic lymph node involvement and residual disease that would merit the increase of treatment to the TDM1, or is that someone who you think prognostically would fit more in the node zero category, like we have seen some data on, albeit not in this specific clinical situation. So obviously you saw where I land. I tend to go up to the TDM1, but I can understand the rationale why somebody would look at 1 millimeter in a lymph node past CR in the breast and say, good enough. I think Ian's point before in that, now that we have all these new drugs, figuring out what is exactly the Goldilocks moment of not too much, not too little, but just right, is a fantastic problem we now have to figure out.
So a couple of adjuvant scenarios, and I agree with that last comment. Ian, we said you've got a 65-year-old patient, ER negative, HER2 positive, the primary is 1.3 centimeter, there are two positive sentinel nodes, and there's a little bit of variation here. Most people say TCHP. Dr. Lin, your colleague, says ACTHP, and Dr. Miller says paclitaxel trastuzumab, pertuzumab. Also, we asked about neratinib in this situation. Everybody says no. So, Ian, any thoughts about this scenario?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is a struggle that we've had as a community now for a long time in terms of what is the optimal chemotherapy backbone to be giving with HER2-directed therapy. And we've argued that both ACTHP, both an anthracycline-based regimen or a non-anthracycline-based regimen are reasonable, have similar efficacies. Toxicity profile is a little different. Obviously, there's a concern about the cardiac toxicity with ACTHP, particularly in an older patient, which is why I think there's a trend towards using less anthracycline in this type of patient. So that's why I put TCHP. But certainly Nancy is not wrong in that an anthracycline-based regimen has very good efficacy as well.
Curious also about Ian, choice of taxane in the localized disease setting, both neoadjuvant and adjuvant, and particularly the issue of substituting paclitaxel for docetaxel, which is maybe better tolerated. What are the situations where you're comfortable with that?
Well, and the regimens that for which we have large data sets are with THP. As you saw in that COMPASS trial, we actually allow for either docetaxel or paclitaxel. And we just don't have a big data set looking at paclitaxel with carboplatin and trastuzumab and pertuzumab. So I think that's where we're a little data free. And so we continue to use docetaxel with that regimen. I think there's a lot of it. There'd be interest in exploring paclitaxel with platinum type of regimen. But for right now, we don't really have data, which is why most of us who are using the TCHP-like regimen would tend to stick with docetaxel, even though we do have concerns about the potential toxicity.
So let's go into another case. And Ginger, maybe you can respond to this patient of Dr. Ma, a young patient, 42 years old, and gets neoadjuvant therapy, has a great response. Radiation therapy is planned, and boom, the patient pops up with a rapidly growing local recurrence. Here's Dr. Ma talking about what happened and posing a few questions.
This is an interesting case. She had neoadjuvant treatment, went to surgery, came back post-op about 2-3 weeks out. We were going to refer her to radiation. That's when her chest wall recurrence happened.
Wow.
And then within 2 weeks, it doubled in size. So basically at that point, we didn't do anything. We didn't even have time to wait for the re-biopsy, re-staining, come back. I just gave her AC at that point. And she responded to AC pretty well. She did have brain mets, had two occipital metastases. So she had SBRT to her brain lesions. After AC, we put her on TDM1. She had very severe liver toxicity to TDM1. We aborted everything. The thought was to put on neratinib and capecitabine as a next treatment, but her platelet count was not great. So we started on neratinib first and tolerated neratinib really well, had no diarrhea at all, and didn't progress at all. So we never added capecitabine. So she just based on neratinib single agent since March 2020 and has done well up until now. And the last scan is still good for her. At the time, tucatinib was not approved. So my question would be, say, if she does progress, what the panelists thought on going to tucatinib in patients who are refractory, resistant to neratinib? And the other option, of course, is T-DXd. So my question for that is T-DXd coverage for central nervous system would favor tucatinib because it's seen as penetrant, but it's more similar to neratinib. So T-DXd will be different, but I don't know it's seen as coverage. So I'm curious panelists' opinion on that.
So Ginger, you know, we start going into real cases, you get all kinds of, this is the way practice is. Everything is a little bit different. So I guess first your thought about management of this rapidly growing local recurrence. And also in terms of the current situation, an interesting point about this patient actually got started neratinib a year ago, which is hard to believe. And tucatinib wasn't even approved a year ago. And we're still talking about it like we've been using it for years. But anyhow, any thoughts about what happened here and this idea of what you would do if she had disease progression?
So obviously this is a super nasty breast cancer, and we see them unfortunately all too often in younger women. The fact that the provider felt it was important to just jump right into the AC is a judgment call. And I think they did what they needed to keep her as safe as they could. And she's now had quite a few HER2 targeted therapies with either difficulty tolerating them. It really hasn't been until they've landed on the neratinib that she's had what looks like any level of achieving a durable benefit from the therapy. Unfortunate, she's also developed brain mets. So what to do next? I would say that there is data on the use of tucatinib after neratinib. Neratinib as a prior medication was allowed in the HER2CLIMB trial, and it's not a large percentage of patients who had it, but there were some. Can't get down to the subset analyses specifically and know what that means, but in a patient like this, I think everything's on the table. If you wanted to use trastuzumab deruxtecan, depending on what her site of progression is the next time that that occurs, if it's systemic, that would be compelling. If this is going to be one of those brain-only, brain-dominant metastatic cases that we often see, then I don't see any reason to not consider using the tucatinib, and she has the opportunity of receiving it in the HER2CLIMB regimen with the capecitabine and the trastuzumab since the CAPE was never started with the neratinib.
So I want to go on to another case, and this is actually a case of Dr. Rodriguez, a young woman, a 36-year-old patient who actually starts out with ER-positive, HER2-positive disease, and again, along the way of her long course, ends up converting to HER2-equivocal, HER2-FISH-negative. Sarah, I'm going to ask you to comment on this. She wasn't sure what to do, the fact that she'd flipped and decided to use T-DXd. Here's Dr. Rodriguez's questions about this case.
We decided to re-challenge her with anti-HER2 therapy, and right now she started femtrastuzumab deruxtecan and is tolerating it well. I found that for the patients who are sensitive to anti-HER2 therapy, this treatment can really slow down disease and get responses. I wanted to hear from the group with this newer treatment that may have toxicity to the lung. How do you evaluate for interstitial lung disease? And do you do any routine imaging of the lung? Especially now that we're seeing people, a lot of patients by telemedicine sometimes, like how do you, what kind of symptoms are you looking for? And what is the interval to evaluate the lung? And if you have seen interstitial pneumonitis related to this drug, what has been the management of that? What's the recommended management? Especially in this patient that we were not able to demonstrate that she was HER2 positive by immunohistochemistry, but we have some hope or suspicion that she may be HER2 low. Do we have any data of the role of trastuzumab deruxtecan in that setting of HER2 low metastatic breast cancer?
So Sarah, of course, we're talking about T-DXd in our lung programs and our GI programs and our GU programs. And everybody wants to know about the issue of pulmonary toxicity, how to screen for it, look more carefully for it. And also, again, getting back to this issue where you have patients who are going from clearly HER2 positive to HER2 low, do you think more about T-DXd and any update in terms of what we know about the impact in HER2 low disease?
Yeah, so first, the interstitial lung disease that we see with T-DXd, the updated analysis of DESTINY-Breast01 presented at San Antonio, there was one additional death in that study, bringing the grade 5 event rate up to 2.7%. So it is a real issue. Somewhere between 10 to 15% of patients will have lower grade ILD or grade 1 through 4 ILD. So it is something we need to be watching for. And currently, in our patients where they're being treated for metastatic disease, we are presumably scanning their lungs looking for progression or responses. And if we start to see ground glass opacities or infiltrates, we should be stopping therapy immediately, talking to our patient, seeing whether they have shortness of breath, fever, dyspnea, cough, those symptoms. So even with grade 1 ILD, which is imaging findings only, we should hold therapy, repeat imaging in 4 weeks, and not resume therapy until it's resolved. For grade 2 and greater, you absolutely need to get pulmonology involved, start steroids, of course, rule out COVID, which can look very much like ILD as well. So, and permanently not discontinue the use of this drug with grade 2 and above. In terms of the HER2 heterogeneity, I see cases like this in my practice more often, I think, than is seen in the community practice, probably because they get referred to me because they're complicated cases. So it makes me feel like they're more common than I think they are. And they are challenging. And again, as we talked about a little bit earlier, I use my pathologist experts in this arena and don't hesitate to retest old tissue, archive tissue, and really try and wrap my brain around what is going on, what is the underlying biology of this tumor. It's pretty rare that there are two populations of cancer cells, a biphenotypic tumor, where you see sort of the seesaw where you're treating with a HER2-directed therapy and then the HER2-negative component rises. And then when you treat with endocrine therapy, the HER2 component rises. That's pretty uncommon, but it can occur. T-DXd has shown early phase 1b data supporting its use in HER2 low, so it would make sense to use it in a tumor that has lower HER2 expression like this. It's not yet FDA approved. The DESTINY-Breast04 study is ongoing to compare T-DXd to standard chemotherapy in patients with HER2 low breast cancer. And if it's a positive study, this is roughly 2/3 of hormone receptor positive breast cancer, and about 1/3 of triple negative breast cancers can be classified as HER2 low. So it may be a therapy that we can use in a large percentage of patients who wouldn't be candidates for HER2 directed therapies otherwise.
Ayan, any thoughts about this, particularly in terms of HER2 low and where that's heading? Also, your thoughts about, I don't know if you have any, in terms of other tumors besides breast. I mentioned lung, where we have good data with HER2 mutant disease, and then gastroesophageal and colon, where it looks like you see benefit with HER2 amplified disease. What about HER2 low and some of these other tumors? Any interest in, is that being looked at as well? And any thoughts about what's going on with these HER2 low patients, Ayan?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with Sarah that this is potentially a hugely impactful intervention in breast cancer if that DESTINY trial that's comparing T-DXd versus chemotherapy in HER2 low patients, if that trial shows a positive result, it really does open up a new targeted therapy to a whole new subtype of breast cancer, essentially, since right now we don't think of HER2 low and HER2 positive. We think of HER2 positive and HER2 negative, and the HER2 lows are just grouped together with the HER2 negatives. So we could basically create a whole new subtype of breast cancer if that trial is positive. And I think there's a really substantial chance it will be positive, since in the phase 1b study of about 50 patients, the response rate was in the high 30s with pretty substantial progression-free survival. So the drug definitely looks active in that HER2 low population, which I think will be great for patients. And as you said, it seems every place they try this drug, it seems to have efficacy across different tumor histologies. And once it's been clear that it works in these clearly HER2 overexpressing cancers, the HER2 mutant cancers, then exploring lower levels of HER2 seems like the natural thing to do, just like we did in breast cancer. So I think there's certainly plenty of potential new areas for this drug to have benefit going forward.
So, Ginger, we're going to present one more case. This is another patient of Dr. Astrow's, 64-year-old woman who presents with a large ulcerated breast mass and unfortunately had metastatic disease to the liver as well. The patient had a great response to THP, but then had severe diarrhea, which switched to T-DM1, had problems with that in terms of peripheral neuropathy and abdominal pain after 3 cycles, and actually ended up on T-DXd and is actually responding to it and tolerating well. Here's Dr. Astrow's comments and questions about this case.
This is a patient who came in with a large ulcerated breast mass. She had multiple liver mets. I started her on THP, docetaxel, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab. Then with that, she had complete healing of the breast mass. Again, this is a bad, ulcerated, painful mass, bleeding, draining, completely healed. But she had grade 3 diarrhea. It was really bad. So I had to stop the THP, and I switched her to T-DM1, which I gave her for 3 cycles, for which we developed severe abdominal pain and worsening peripheral neuropathy. So I switched her to the new agent, T-DXd, and I've given her 6 cycles of that, which she is tolerating better than the previous agents. I just got a CAT scan of her abdomen pelvis, the decrease in size and number of liver mets. How long should I continue her on this treatment? That's the question.
Any questions you have about T-DXd?
How should I be monitoring for pulmonary toxicity?
Did she delay coming in and that's why it was such a big mass?
Yes,
or no?
She delayed. In most of these cases, there's some delay in treatment, whether it's denial sometimes, sometimes it's fear, sometimes it's financial issues, lack of insurance. Their family didn't know about it. There are all kinds of reasons why all of us will ignore problems.
I really like that last thought, all of us, not just the patients. I can relate to that completely. So curious, Ginger, what your thoughts are, practical question about how long to continue treatment, and also any thoughts about this phenomenon, of course, we've all in oncology known about for a long time, of patients who kind of seem to be responsible, they have jobs, taking care of kids or whatever, and yet have this denial that's focused on their breast present with advanced disease. Any thoughts, Ginger?
Yeah. So I think typically with the majority of the agents that we use, we would keep treating this patient because she's had liver mets and it sounds like they're still visible, that she did not have a situation where she's gone to no evidence of disease at all. Whether or not she would ever merit a drug holiday, I usually base that on tolerance. With the T-DXd, the question of watching for the pulmonary fibrosis, which is something that has been described in patients who have been on the therapy for longer as opposed to shorter duration, becomes tricky. And so I think I would keep her on therapy, but be very mindful of the fact that that toxicity could arise and be watching for it. And as Sarah said earlier, we're pretty routinely scanning these patients. Sometimes when I have patients who are doing very well on therapy, I will liberalize the frequency with which I'm doing their scans. But on the T-DXd, because of the pulmonary toxicity potential, I probably would not do that in her case. And then getting to the fact that she presented with what appears to have been a somewhat ignored breast cancer is quite unfortunate. She sounds like she's had an amazing response in her breast, for which we are grateful. But I'm looking for any evidence of recurrence in her chest wall because it sounds like she's not had any local therapy there or radiation of any kind. So we still have local maneuvers to consider to try and avoid her ending up with any kind of chest wall problematic wound-based type recurrence or progression of her disease down the line.
So yeah, that's a really important point. Sarah, where are we today? I know we've seen some data over the last few years about the impact of local therapy, surgery, radiation to the breast in patients with metastatic disease. there was a period of time where their thinking was maybe that would impact the long-term outcome. How did that sort of play out?
Yeah, the ECOG Akron study was presented at ASCO last year, where they took patients with de novo metastatic breast cancer of all subtypes and randomly assigned women to either receive local regional therapy. Everybody received systemic therapy for 4 to 8 cycles, and then they were assigned to receive local regional therapy, so surgery to the breast tumor versus delayed surgery for palliation alone. And there really was no evidence of impact on overall survival. When they did the subset analysis, HER2 positive did just as well with or without doing surgery, immediate or at the time of need of palliation. Triple negative actually did worse by doing local surgery immediately. So we don't have good evidence. There have been studies done with inconsistent results. This doesn't sort of address patients with oligometastatic disease where maybe you can do radiation to a couple of lesions. It doesn't address whether there are patients who may benefit from a more aggressive local regional approach. But at this point, I think the totality of evidence favors utilizing surgery when needed for palliation.
So I want to go through a few more of the survey questions that we pose. And Ian, here's a first-line therapy of metastatic disease. And again, we say this patient gets TCHP previously in the neoadjuvant setting, followed by trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and then has a disease recurrence at 6 months. Everybody says TDM1. But when we say the recurrence occurred 18 months later, it gets a little more variable. And you see a bunch of people going back to trastuzumab, pertuzumab plus chemo. Any thoughts, and that includes you, Ian, about how you think through first-line therapy based on intervals since surgery?
Yeah, so we're starting to get into a data-free zone when we talk about patients who received pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting and TDM1 in the adjuvant setting, how that impacts our decisions to use those same drugs in the metastatic setting. We just don't have those data since the original metastatic trials were done before people received those drugs in the early disease setting. So I think you kind of have to use some common sense and intuition, and that's why you start seeing there's clear responses when there's the recurrence is very short after pertuzumab. Nobody wanted to use pertuzumab again. Everybody switched to TDM1. But now that you've gotten a patient who's a little further away, is it reasonable to go back to pertuzumab or should you switch to TDM1? And I think that's where you start seeing some difference. My personal sense was that it's been 18 months. There are the data with pertuzumab in the first-line metastatic setting is so good with a very large survival benefit that it seems worth trying that again and see if you get benefit. If you don't, then you can always go to TDM1 after that. We try to get as much mileage as we can from each of our therapies so that we can extend patients' disease control as long as possible. So in this case, it's 1.5 years later after they've had pertuzumab. We can switch to a different chemotherapy backbone, which is why I suggested using vinorelbine, which has been tested in the first line setting with pertuzumab, and try to get some mileage out of that before you go to the next line of therapy. But it's certainly not wrong to consider using TDM1 in that patient, but I think there's a real chance that she would have benefit from chemo HP, and why not try it?
So here's another variation on the second line question, Sarah. Although I guess you could, in a way, look at it as sort of third line. But any event, this is a patient who gets neoadjuvant TCHP followed by TDM1 for residual disease, and then 6 months later has disease in their liver. And so, again, first-line therapy, metastatic disease, but actually third line of therapy. So it looks like there's a consensus here, just kidding, pretty split between HerClimb and T-DXd. Any thoughts, Sarah?
Yeah, I would just say that both are right. Both are approved in the third line setting, and both have great activity in this setting. The reason I chose tucatinib-based therapy is I think she has very bad behaving disease. She's kind of blown through. She didn't have a pathologic complete response to TCHP, and then she had a metastatic recurrence in the liver. I think she's at very high risk of brain metastases. I believe it was also ER negative, if I'm correct. And so that those place her at very high risk of CNS metastases. So I wanted to get her treated with a TKI that has activity and protection there to try and delay that. However, we have no head-to-head evidence comparing that regimen to T-DXd. We know T-DXd has got phenomenal activity against liver metastases and visceral metastases with an objective response rate of 61% in this setting. It's probably going to work well. The bottom line is sequencing, we don't know how to do it at this point, but what's likely is that most patients will get both types of therapy. We don't know if there's a benefit to ordering them one way or the other.
So it kind of also gets into the question of where are we heading in terms of second line therapy and ion. Here's another clinical scenario that starts to get into some of the issues that come up in this situation. This is a patient who has disease recurrence in the liver and brain after neoadjuvant TCHP followed by trastuzumab, pertuzumab. So a lot of people are saying tucatinib in the second line or the HERCLIMB approach in the second line situation. Kathy Miller says TDM1 and INU kind of have two alternatives you think about. Can you talk about how you think through second line therapy, Ian, in a patient who has brain mets?
Yeah, so to me, I think the big question is, are these few brain metastases that can be treated with local therapy effectively? And if so, then I would recommend doing that and then kind of putting them back to their usual paradigm of first, second, and third line treatment. If this is a person who has innumerable brain mets and the only way to control them would have been to use whole brain radiation, which is we try to avoid early on because of long-term sequelae, that would be a patient I would use the only regimen for which we have good data on progressive brain mets, and that's the tucatinib regimen. So that's why I answer the question in that way. If this is a patient in whom SRS is possible, I would do that, and then I would go back to the same scenario that we talked about before in an 18-month patient who didn't have brain mets, and that's to use chemotherapy and trastuzumab and pertuzumab. If that's not possible and you need to get control of the brain mets without radiation, then I would use the tucatinib regimen because of its clear efficacy in patients with active brain mets.
So another common question that comes up, Ginger, is the patient who the doc wants to give the HERCLIMB regimen, but the patient's already had capecitabine. We've had patients who are progressing on capecitabine, patients who couldn't tolerate capecitabine in the past. So we asked as part of our survey, would you administer tucatinib without the triplet that was used in the HERCLIMB study, including the possibility, really the main thing here would be a capecitabine. And actually, some people say they've already done it, including you, Ginger, but others say they wouldn't do it. So what are your thoughts about this, Ginger?
Yes, I feel like I should start this off by saying, hello, my name is Ginger, and I have done this. I will admit, to date, in all honesty, I have only done this once, and it was the specific scenario you alluded to, which it's a young woman. She has bad breast cancer. It has progressed early and with brain-only breast cancer metastasis, and so I've had a lot of these patients who end up very brain dominant disease, and she is not able to tolerate capecitabine. That's been proven in the past. And so I'm stuck with, she's not eligible for any of our clinical trials because of the findings on the MRI with a suggestion of a touch of leptomeningeal disease, and it's not been cytologically proven. The CSF is negative, but still, when you're looking at the MRI, it's concerning and convincing that that's where we are probably heading. So I have given her the tucatinib in combination with T-DM1. As we talked about earlier in the presentation, there is a phase 1b study, so there is safety data for this, and there was very good efficacy in that trial, albeit for standard brain mets, no LMD data there, but the patient doesn't have a lot of options. If she was eligible for a clinical trial, that would be my first choice, but I don't think she should die of CNS-dominant HER2-positive breast cancer without the opportunity of having received tucatinib. So I have.
So, Ian, I was curious about this next question. We had out there, there was an ASCO guidelines paper a couple years ago about CNS mets and HER2-positive disease. And one of the things they put out there was for the patient who's stable and responding systemically with disease progression to continue the systemic therapy and treat the disease locally. I was curious, typically in the past, it's not been obviously a tucatinib, but I was just kind of curious with tucatinib whether people would feel the same way. It looks like pretty much everybody embraces that algorithm. Ian, any comments?
Yeah, so actually I was involved in that guideline panel, and back when we wrote that, which was a while ago, we didn't have strong data on doing this. But now actually with tucatinib, we have clear data. In HER2CLIMB, they allowed patients who had isolated CNS progression to get local radiation and then continue on therapy. And in those patients who did that, the PFS, I think, was more than 7 months for the patients who continued their tucatinib-based treatment. So you definitely can get substantial further disease control without having to change your systemic therapy once you treat locally the brain metastases. So I think now we have very clear data that this is the right approach.
So, Ian, another question that comes up, and I hear general oncologists bringing this up because they hear this in lung cancer, where with targeted therapy, the paradigm has been if you have patients with asymptomatic brain mets, particularly if it's going to require whole brain radiation therapy, no cerebral edema, that they'll use targeted therapy without radiation, for example, osimertinib in an EGFR tumor. What about in HER2-positive breast cancer, tucatinib, or other systemic therapies? Any situations, Ian, like that where you would just treat systemically primarily rather than, for example, using whole brain?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we talked about that was similar to the case that we had a few slides ago, that you have a patient who is relatively early in their course, and if they have brain metastases that are not treatable with SRS and you would have to use whole brain to control it, then I think it does make sense to use a drug with clear CNS penetration and clear CNS activity like tucatinib, which is a way to stave off having to use whole brain and therefore hopefully delaying any of the cognitive toxicities associated with whole brain radiation. So yeah, I mean, I think now that we have these HER2CLIMB data that show unequivocally that this drug combination is active in patients with progressive brain metastases, then I do think it makes sense to use it as a way to delay having to use whole brain.
So another issue, Sarah, and I think it was referred to by one of the docs previously, is the question of the CNS activity of TDXD. And I would also add, I'm curious about your thoughts about the CNS activity of TDM1. We had one of our cases in one of our webinars presented. Patient had like a 20-month CNS ongoing response to brain mets with TDM1. We asked in this survey, what would you do with a patient who has disease progression, including CNS progression, tucatinib, trastuzumab, capecitabine, and everybody says TDXD. Sarah, what do we know about antibody-drug conjugates, both TDXD as well as TDM1 in the brain?
Yeah, so the assumption is that these bulky molecules cannot penetrate the blood-brain barrier. But in a patient who has had brain radiation, brain surgery, the blood-brain barrier is probably not as intact as we'd assumed. And some would even say that in patients who have brain metastases, the bulky cancer cells that crossed over the blood-brain barrier have made that blood-brain barrier somewhat leaky. And so people begin to wonder whether or not these bulky molecules can actually get into the central nervous system and have activity there. There are case reports and some analyses of studies looking at antibody-drug conjugates like TDM1 and TDXD that indicate some responses in the CNS. Now, in the case series that I've looked at with TDM1, patients had had radiation, stereotactic radiosurgery, or CNS surgeries, so that blood-brain barrier was not intact. The analysis of patients who went on with stable brain metastases, the DESTINY-Breast01 study, and received TDXD, these patients, it was not entirely clear based on my memory how close to going on study they had received brain radiation to control their brain metastases. And we can see responses in the brain months after radiation to the brain. So I don't think we've definitively studied this with antibody drug conjugates, but I do think that in a patient like this who's progressing, having CNS progression on tucatinib-based therapy, that switching to a very potent ADC that has great extracranial activity makes sense. What we do need to know and establish right now is whether or not neratinib works in patients whose disease has progressed on tucatinib. And there was a poster, I think, at San Antonio looking preclinically at the potency of neratinib, tucatinib, and lapatinib. And neratinib, while it is quite promiscuous and hits other kinases a lot, causing toxicity, it does appear to have the most potency against HER2. So perhaps it will have activity in patients whose disease has progressed on tucatinib. It really needs to be explored.
Another point about neratinib, Sarah, I'm curious for your thoughts on, is the current status in terms of tolerability. We do see people using it in ER-positive, HER2-positive, higher-risk patients, multiple node positives, et cetera. And, of course, in the beginning, when it was first brought out, there was a lot of issues with diarrhea, et cetera. Now I'm starting to hear investigators, even docs in practice, are using dose escalation mitigation strategies, a lot better reports. What's your thoughts and experience, Sarah?
Yeah, we participated in the control trial, which was looking at just this issue in the extended adjuvant setting, what measures can actually mitigate the side effect of grade 3-4 diarrhea, which was around 40% in the Extinet study. Measures such as budesonide, which is a GI acting steroid, it's not systemically absorbed, cholestipol, which is a bile acid sequestrant, or Lamotil, or a combination of these, as you said, dose escalation, starting at a lower dose of neratinib and escalating over the course of a month as tolerated. And we did see that the grade 3 diarrhea rates dropped down into the 15 to 25% range, which is a lot better. And I think motivated patients and watchful clinicians can now, I think, get patients through the treatment with neratinib. But I think this is why patients should be selected based on their risk of disease. The benefits really do appear to be restricted to hormone receptor positive breast cancer. And I would recommend this mainly for patients who had nodal disease or residual disease after standard neoadjuvant therapy, given this side effect.
So speaking of hormone receptors and endocrine therapy, I'm curious, Ginger, about your thoughts about the use of hormonal therapy in HER2-positive disease. It's interesting how a lot of trials keep HER2 patients out of the studies, and then you see advances and you wonder what to do with it. For example, CDK, which initially there wasn't any data in HER2-positive, now we have some. I'm curious how you use hormonal therapy in HER2-positive disease, Ginger. Do you use CDK inhibitors? Also, there's an adjuvant Abema trial that was presented at ESMO, very high-risk patients. But again, not sure exactly how it's going to play out in the HER2-negative patients. But again, is that something that theoretically you would consider in a patient with HER2-positive disease? Just your general thoughts about the use of hormonal therapy, Ginger, in HER2-positive metastatic disease.
Yeah, so I think we're increasingly realizing that as we start to subdivide breast cancer, even in the HER2 space, it's two different diseases. There's the dual ER-positive or triple-positive HER2-positive breast cancers, and then the ER-PR-negative HER2-positive. And we've seen lots of presentations that help us determine there's differences in how people benefit from both ER-targeted therapies and HER2-targeted therapies, depending upon what that other pathway is doing in the breast cancer. We've actually conducted a clinical trial that was presented at San Antonio last year, where it was a combination of letrozole, palbociclib, and tucatinib as an all-oral regimen, non-chemo regimen, specifically for this patient population. And the results were favorable. We saw a progression-free survival that was equivalent to the two phase 1b studies that had originally used tucatinib in combination with either T-DM1 or the capecitabine trastuzumab triple combo that went forward into the HER2CLIMB trial. So there's an emerging level of data that if you get at both pathways and you will do a better job of targeting the resistance mechanisms that come downstream of it. And the role of CDK4/6 inhibition in that downstream resistant looks important. And in the olden days, before we had all of these great HER2-targeted therapies, we would often put these patients on anti-endocrine therapy first, and that didn't really have great benefit. And we know from the early clinical trials of ER-targeted drugs in combination with trastuzumab, there was not a lot of added benefit seen to the HER2 target there. So figuring out what we're going to do with this now that we have the CDK4/6 inhibition is important. I will say in the premenopausal space, I do make sure all of my women have their ovaries shut off or removed eventually if they have metastatic disease, because I think that's one thing that we can often forget about when we're seeing a HER2 positive breast cancer and getting focused on what drug to choose of the good options that we have right now.
I am curious about your thoughts in the adjuvant setting in terms of hormonal therapy. One of the questions that comes up, sometimes you run into patients who refuse chemo, or patients are old and frail. They don't want any chemo, even paclitaxel or even T-DM1. We saw the PERTAIN data using just hormonal therapy and anti-HER therapy metastatic disease. Any situations where you use that kind of strategy, Ian, in the HER2 positive situation? And as long as I'm bringing that up, any thoughts about the adjuvant Abema study, both in HER2 negative and HER2 positive?
All right. So certainly in the adjuvant setting, adjuvant endocrine therapy for HER2 positive disease has benefit. And we even have data from the SOFT and TEXT study suggesting that the HER2 positive patients benefit at least as well as everybody else from adding ovarian suppression to their endocrine therapy. So it's definitely true that in the adjuvant setting that we should be using some endocrine therapy for these patients, just like we would anybody else with ER positive disease. And in the metastatic setting, it's a little bit more complicated because we have so many other effective HER2 therapies. But as you alluded to, there are data now from the MONARCH HER study showing pretty impressive efficacy with the combination of abemaciclib, trastuzumab, and fulvestrant. And so that, while not FDA-approved regimen, certainly something that could be considered for a patient who you're looking to avoid using chemotherapy for in the metastatic setting. And of course, the PERTAIN data showed very good first-line efficacy with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, an aromatase inhibitor, or at least some endocrine backbone. And so for a patient who's has asymptomatic, relatively low-burden ER-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer in the first line, then I think using that regimen and avoiding a taxane would certainly be a reasonable option as a first line. In terms of abemaciclib in the adjuvant setting, we're all thrilled about the data from MONARCH E showing a big benefit in high-risk ER-positive, HER2-negative cancers. We don't have data in HER2-positive cancers. I would not use it in the HER2-positive, ER-positive patients until we had more data, just because it's pretty early on. And again, we have these patients generally do very well without additional therapy.
So in a second, I'm going to get back to the survey, but there's no way I'm going to be talking to any breast cancer investigators and not ask you about Olympia. So I'm assuming either you don't know the data, or if you do, you're not going to talk about it. But I am kind of curious what your thoughts are about it. And I'll start with you, Sarah. Any speculations about what we're going to see in the ovarian situation? Of course, completely different cancer, but the SOLO-1 trial in ovary, olaparib, the risk reduction hazard rate was 0.3, and it continues out to 5 years. Who knows what we're going to see here? But of course, again, no HER2 positive patients. So first of all, any speculations about what we're going to see and what it's going to mean, Sarah? And if it is something that people are going to want to jump on, what about for the HER2 positive patients?
Yeah, I don't know the data, so I'm not at risk of divulging anything. I'm hoping we see a hazard ratio on the order of 0.5. This would be phenomenal, especially for our patients who have BRCA1 or triple negative BRCA-associated breast cancers. This would be really huge, not just for the efficacy standpoint, but the tolerability of these drugs is really good when you compare it to the tolerability even of immune checkpoint inhibitors. I know that's sacrilege. I shouldn't be going against ICI, but I think PARP inhibitors are better tolerated and have fewer risks in the adjuvant setting, life-threatening, long-term, irreversible risks, even though it's rare with immune checkpoint inhibitors. We see it more there. Yes, most of the studies of PARP inhibitors excluded patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. The large studies did. But there are patients with BRCA2 mutations who do have HER2-positive breast cancer. So presumably these drugs should work there. Should we be combining them with HER2-targeted agents? Probably. Has that been studied? Not extensively. So I think we have such effective therapies in the HER2-positive realm. I wouldn't use olaparib in a HER2-positive breast cancer patient outside of a clinical trial if it is approved, because it hasn't been studied in that realm. And there are toxicities to be worried about without the data supporting its use.
Ian, any thoughts about this? I'm also thinking about how it's going to affect the workup of patients with localized breast cancer. Right now, if you have ovarian cancer, you walk through the door, you're going to get germline panel, you're going to get NGS. I mean, I'm wondering, is that what's going to happen in breast cancer? I don't know. But any thoughts about this trial, Ian, and kind of where you see things heading with that?
Yeah, no, I like Sarah, I am not at risk for being arrested for divulging confidential information because I don't know the data. I just know the press release, which is certainly great news and not so surprising given how well these drugs work in the metastatic setting. So I do think we should be tested, just like now it's standard to test metastatic patients for germline mutations. We should start testing our early disease patients for germline testing as well, because it will gate, presumably, the use of these PARP inhibitors. And I think we're already testing a lot of patients now anyway, but I think once, if the drug does get approved in that setting, then we should be testing everybody, because it's very clear that you miss people if you just stick to tight criteria. But no, I think this is great news, and hopefully the data will be as positive as Sarah is suspecting, and I think there's a very good chance it will be.
So, Ginger, I'm curious about your thoughts on this and also your experience, if any, using PARP inhibitors in metastatic HER2-positive disease. As Sarah said, you do occasionally see patients with BRCA germline mutations, for example. If they get beyond 4 or 5 lines of therapy, have you used PARP inhibitors in those patients, Ginger?
Well, this is giving me a good idea, because I can't think of a patient in which I have done that. So either my BRCA carrying HER2 positive patients haven't metastasized, or I've forgotten about it. But no, I've not done that in metastatic patients. I think once you get to late line therapies, I encourage everyone to send folks in for consideration of a clinical trial, even if they have to travel for some, because it's the brave women who are willing to help us engage in our phase 1 and phase 1b studies that really help us move the field forward. If that's an impossibility, then I think when you're at 8th, 9th, 10th line therapy, or 7th, 8th line therapy, pick your line in the sand, so to speak, it's hard to get critical of people who are trying to offer treatments. I think we just at that point in time have to be careful that we are offering treatments that are worthwhile to offer, because everything does have toxicity, and time coming into the clinic and time spent seeing us for their care, if their disease is that far down the line, is a different level of discussion that we have to make sure we're very patient facing about. But if somebody's still in great shape and wants to try things, I've certainly used it in all of my BRCA positive patients who are HER2 negative in the metastatic setting, incorporated into different lines of their therapy. And then I too am hopeful for the Olympia trial. I will not be wearing the orange jumpsuit for divulging secrets either, but we're all looking forward to that actually being released in full and getting the chance to dive into it. And the more we understand what is driving breast cancer, the better we can effectively treat it with the lesser side effects. HER2 was the most obvious example of that in our field so far, and hopefully this will be a great opportunity for the BRCA-driven ones.
So one other issue I'd like to get your take on, and again, we asked about it in the survey, Sarah, margetuximab. So we asked, are people planning to use it? I was kind of surprised how these answers, a lot of people saying 5th line, Erica Hamilton saying she's not planning on using it, and yet Ginger saying after tucatinib, trastuzumab, daratuxan. Sarah, can you just review for us what we know about this and what your thoughts are about utilizing it today?
You didn't ask Hope. So you would have had even a different response there.
What would Hope have said, incidentally?
I don't know.
Second line?
Second line, maybe. Neoadjuvant. It's a drug that unfortunately came at a time when a lot of exciting drugs had data come out, right? So it's been overshadowed with the excitement of tucatinib and T-DXd and then T-DM1 in the adjuvant setting. So I feel sorry for it if you can feel sorry for a drug. I mean, from an engineering standpoint, it's a cool drug. It engages more tightly with the Fc receptors, which helps 85% of patients have an Fc gamma receptor that binds antibodies less tightly. So it's capitalizing on that and making the ADCC response better. Presumably, this drug would be more effective in earlier lines, less heavily pretreated settings when patients' immune system is better able to generate an ADCC response. So there are studies, I believe, in the neoadjuvant setting ongoing looking at this drug, and that may be showing good, exciting data. I do like the fact that the toxicity profile of this drug is so good. I mean, some infusion-related reactions, but overall really does very much look like trastuzumab. I just think that the other drugs that have data come out for all the reasons we've discussed today are going to overshadow it and are going to be used earlier unless margetuximab can show benefit in a much earlier setting, first line setting to replace trastuzumab or the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting. And then the question becomes, is that modest benefit really worth the price? We now have biosimilars and subcutaneous forms of trastuzumab. Are we really going to be showing there's such a benefit by using this drug that it should replace maybe a more affordable strategy.
Ginger, any thoughts?
I think it's a drug that highlights the disconnect sometimes between where we're learning cool things scientifically and then the crowded space sometimes in drug development. So margetuximab is a success in that we learned something from our experience with trastuzumab and the other monoclonals about how these drugs bind to the HER2-expressing cancer cells and then turned it into what could be a better mousetrap, but then trying to bring it back into the pool of an non-discriminated patient population and see who benefits, the signal's not that great there. It'll be really interesting to drill down on, are people genetically predisposed to having a better benefit from trastuzumab versus would margetuximab really show us a difference based on the Fc receptor that we inherit from our parents, and figuring out the testing for the CD16A, and could we identify a subpopulation of patients for whom the margetuximab might make a really big difference is where we would hope to see the science with that agent go. Right now, I think my answer is the same thing as fifth line by the time you count up all the prior regimens. And it's an opportunity for something that a patient wouldn't have previously experienced. And so hopefully we'll start to get a better handle on that. But I think the key to margetuximab's success comes in the science of these Fc receptors and seeing how well that plays out as we figure out more.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to the faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Striving for Consensus on the Optimal Management of HER2-Positive Breast Cancer.